Megan Nosel, and thank you for listening to this episode of the SLP Minded Podcast, the show that brings the research to the clinic. Are you SLP minded? Not sure? Do you label yourself as an SLP geek? Do you enjoy critically thinking about the research in our field? Do you have dreams of pursuing a doctorate or conducting your own research study one day? Do you enjoy talking with the researchers, seeking their insight, and hearing about their discoveries? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then the SLP Minded Podcast is definitely for you. The aims of this podcast are to encourage a stronger appreciation for research and to foster a stronger relationship between the researchers and the clinicians. By interviewing medical SLP researchers about their latest studies, discoveries, and the clinical implications of their work, we can definitely think more critically about the ways to improve our own evidence-based practices and patient outcomes. Don't forget to download this episode's references and resources page on the website for more information. Sounds easy enough, right? Sure. Sit back and enjoy this insightful conversation. My guest for today's episode is the lovely Dr. Joanne Patterson. I have been so excited to speak with this woman. I absolutely love her research. She is a clinical academic speech and language pathologist who has over 25 years of clinical experience. She is an honorary senior lecturer at Newcastle University in the UK. She completed her PhD in 2010, during which she reported on swallowing outcomes following head and neck cancer treatment. Her clinical and research interests include head and neck cancer dysphagia, functional outcome measures, cancer survivorship, medically unexplained dysphagia, cricopharyngeal dysfunction, and swallowing intervention development. Today we're going to be talking about her research article titled Feasibility and Acceptability of Combining Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Techniques with Swallowing Therapy in Head and Neck Cancer Dysphagia, which was published in BMC Cancer in January of 2018. So I'm just really thankful for your time today, and I'm really excited because counseling is this interest of mine, and I feel like you can be the best clinician and you have can have all the wonderful treatment techniques and the assessments, and you can be a really big star in those areas. But then if you can't counsel someone through things, I think that is probably why we have such poor adherence and we have such sometimes inconsistent progress. And so that's why I found your research really interesting.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, because you don't actually hear any of that stuff being described, do you, in a lot of the work that is talking about swallowing therapy. And you kind of think, that's not quite how it is in my clinic.
Exactly. Well, and I just did a survey of people who are working with head and neck cancer patients. I put it out on the Facebook forums, just in the SLP forums, and 200 SLPs responded to it. And the number one thing that they feel least confident in is counseling head and neck cancer patients by a large margin.
Yeah, really? Yeah.
It was very surprising to me on one hand. And on the other hand, I supervise graduate clinicians, and I think I probably have a little more background in counseling than other clinicians, and so I really focus heavily on that.
I think if you can get that right, you know, the other stuff, you know, the more I think about it, the essential stuff is about that kind of alliance with a person, an individual that comes out of that kind of counseling approach.
Yes.
You need to get that right, don't you, in order to be able to do the other stuff. But yeah, that is surprising.
I don't know how it is in the SLP's training in your country, but in our programs in general, we have one counseling class. And what I hear people saying is, and I loved my program. I felt very prepared afterwards. However, we're not taught specific counseling techniques.
Yeah.
We talk about theoretical things.
Yeah. I think just thinking about what we do here, because I do input into the undergraduate program in a small way, and we do basic counseling, probably about 10 hours worth of training, and then I do a couple of sessions on CBT as well. But I'm not sure, it would be interesting to know whether therapists then go out, you need to go out and use it, don't you, and you need to practice it. And
it does require a lot of practice.
I have a sense it possibly goes by the wayside for a while.
That's wonderful that you're actually teaching some techniques. That's not something that is typical here.
Yeah.
And I really went, how did you get into CBT?
My kind of counselling training I did in the mid 90s as a postgraduate diploma, and I did person-centred counselling at that time because that's what was around. That's what was,
Interesting.
and then so I kind of had training in that, and then I probably because of the stuff that was coming out my PhD. That was around swallowing outcomes and head and neck cancer. It kind of struck me that there was a lot of stuff around how the psychosocial issues around dysphagia, but no interventions were being talked about for that. And I went on a, I first of all went on a very short course. It was brilliant. It was only for 3 days. And that taught us some very basic kind of CBT techniques. And I put those into practice. I really enjoyed it. And I put those, I tried that out on a small number of cases. And I happened to be sharing an office when I was doing my PhD with he's now Professor Deary, who was doing his PhD on CBT and dysphonia. And so I guess it was a kind of merging of all of those things that then kind of led me to seek further funding to see if I could really develop this as an intervention. And then as part of that, I took a diploma in CBT, and so I had some very that was a very practical as well as a theoretical kind of course over 18 months. But I would say to therapists that I don't think it's you in order to do this type of intervention, I don't think everybody needs to do the diploma. I think that short course was actually enough to get me going. And then subsequent to that, I've done some other sort of training in acceptance and commitment therapy, and some mindfulness as well. So, yeah, so I've got, yeah, I've kind of dipped my toe into those areas too.
Well, that's very exciting to me because actually I have been looking into this. We have this thing here called the Health Coach Certification Course, and it's a 3-day course. And I'm wondering if it's similar to what you've described. It reviews basic techniques. It includes CBT, mindfulness, various techniques, and you can apply that into anything that you're doing in the health world. If you there are nurses who take the course, there are doctors who take the course, there are dietitians, and it's a 3-day intensive course, and it's quite expensive, but I feel like it's something up my alley because I'm really interested in this.
No, that sounds. I'm sure that there's a lot of similarities within. Certainly for me, when I look at things like CBT, acceptance and commitment, mindfulness, and some elements of motivational interviewing, I think they're all in the same vein. And some of the techniques, I think I probably now have a mixture. of those things. So it's always helpful to have a number of different tools in your therapy toolbox.
Oh, definitely. And clinicians are looking for these tools, and that is,
Yeah.
and like you've described, that we have studied a lot of swallowing exercises and different techniques to use for rehab, but the psychosocial component, which is so prevalent in head and neck cancer patients, what are we doing about that? And like you said, so that is very exciting to me. And I just, could you describe CBT for us, cognitive behavioral therapy, for people who have not heard the term or don't know much about it?
So CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. So I guess that comes under kind of talking therapies, and it comes from the domains of cognitive therapy and behavioral therapy. And there's a lot of evidence out there for its use for anxiety and depression. I guess it's based on the idea that the way we think about things, how we feel about them, and how we behave are all interconnected. And negative thoughts could make us feel either anxious or depressed, and subsequently it may sort of alter the way in which we behave. So I was thinking about this before you called, and thinking some of my thought processes were, will Skype work? Will I be able to explain CBS in a coherent way?
No.
All of those things, you know, those sorts of automatic thoughts that were coming were making me feel quite anxious. And in response to that, I was probably procrastinating a little bit and ruminating on it. And physically, I could feel my stomach was feeling just a little bit butterfly. And I suppose that's an example of sort of cognitions, emotions, and behaviors.
We all do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Every day, probably, is just part of our psyche.
Exactly. We thought about it too much. Yeah, we'd be just,
oh my goodness,
seeing all these cycles going on. So the therapy kind of aims to kind of modify some of those thoughts or cognitions and behaviours, and kind of test out whether if we modify them in some way, does that influence the way in which we feel about things? So I think that's the essence of CBT for me.
I love the CBEST. Is this a term you created? Can you explain that for us?
So I haven't patented it, but yes, that's a term that I developed, really, because I wanted to show that this intervention wasn't pure CBT. Because I think, you know, we're dealing with a very physical condition as well, but I wanted to address the psychosocial sequelae of dysphagia too, without limiting to just dealing with the emotions that, you know, that the physical often needs to be addressed too. And so really it's that merging of the talking therapy with a more physical impairment-based therapy. And again, it goes back to that principle of, these are the tools that I have to work with this patient. And I'm not going to limit myself to just working in one paradigm.
I love it. Cognitive Behavioral Enhanced Swallowing Therapy. I love that term. I think it's just a fantastic idea, honestly.
You see, I can already feel my anxiety levels lowering.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. I have been looking forward to speaking with you for like a month, so I'm just so excited. This is the kind of research I'm drawn to as a clinician. I really, really like the counseling side, and yeah, it's something that I have really thought about and I want to learn how to do. So,
well, that's lovely to hear, because obviously I come at this from a clinician. I'm a clinician that does research, and that has its challenges, I suppose, because what we do as clinicians is really complex. And trying to encapsulate that. So as one clinician to another, that's really nice to hear.
Oh, I can't say enough good things about this. So I would like to get into the details of how you did this. So
yeah,
you mentioned that you individualized your treatment sessions for up to about 10 sessions.
Yeah.
How did you individualize? So I think one of these things that clinicians struggle with, how we individualize them is a real skill. And I just wondered if you have a certain method for individualizing the sessions.
I think first of all, it drops out of the therapy goal. So the first sort of session is really spent trying to draw out from the patient what they want to work on. What is it that's bothering them the most? What they're going to prioritize and for us to work on during our therapy sessions. And in the paper, I list the kind of more typical kind of goals, patient goals that people came out with. Once we've established the goal, then I scale it first of all. As I say, if 10 was okay, you've managed to achieve this goal, and 0 was you're so far away from this goal. trying to get some scaling, some measurement, and that's really important to know towards the end, for when you know when you're coming towards the end of the therapy, as to how far they are along that kind of scale. And then usually what happens next is then we build the formulation. And by the formulation, it's also sometimes referred to as a hot cross bun, but the formulation is looking at some of the cognitions, the thoughts that are going along with that, how that's making the individual feel, what are the behaviours they're doing in order to try and manage this problem. And also, as part of this, with it being a physical problem, we also address what the sensations, the physical sensations might be. So you end up with this formulation, and then seeing what the links might be in between those sorts of thoughts and behaviours.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so each goal is going to be individual, each formulation is going to be individual, because you're drawing this out using a technique called Socratic questioning, which is a very kind of naive way of asking questions, probing, being curious, sort of questioning style. So you're not telling, you're not giving advice, you're just trying to draw out what makes you think in that way. What evidence do you have for that? Or is that behavior helping this? Or yeah, is there anything that you could be doing differently? That sort of style of questioning.
Is that motivational interviewing or is that different?
I think it has similarities between them, but I think CBT differs because it's kind of working on the change. It's working therapeutically on the change in behaviors, or modifying behaviors and thoughts. So you end up with that sort of formulation and the goal, and then out of that develops a kind of series of experiments. I don't know whether that's easier to talk through one of the formulations, whether that would help kind of describe where we went to with the therapy from that.
Sure.
Because I know in the paper I've illustrated a couple of formulations on that in one of the figures. So one of the examples of that, and I don't know if you, I'd be interested to see if other people have come across these sorts of patients, that this one individual had a nasogastric tube fitted mid chemoradiotherapy, and she really, her thoughts were that when I met her, probably about 4 weeks after she'd finished treatment, is that she thought her throat wasn't working at all, and that it had completely closed up. And she really felt that this was it forever now, that really wasn't going to work at all, and that was making her feel really anxious and quite scared. And as a result, she was spitting out all of her saliva and into a cup, and avoiding any attempts at swallowing at all. And she would be thinking a lot about her swallowing, about her throat. She'd be monitoring it a lot, thinking about how it felt. And so she was very quickly getting nowhere. This was her stuck, really.
Right.
And so that was her formulation. And so from that, we took that formulation, and I said, just to check out then, what do you think is happening to your saliva when you're sleeping?
Right.
This was something that she hadn't thought about at all. And she said, well, I guess I must be swallowing it. And yeah, and I said, so why do you think you'd be more able to swallow while you're sleeping than you are when you're awake? And she said, well, I guess I must be a little bit more relaxed about it. I'm not thinking about it when I'm sleeping. And so this is setting up the kind of, through Socratic questioning, this kind of, this doesn't quite add up.
Yeah, reasoning.
And so we came then to the hypothesis that the more relaxed she was, her swallowing may be a little bit better. And then the next question was, so what could you do in order to sort of test this out? And so she said, well, I could try just swallowing my saliva sometimes. And that she would try that when she was with a grandson, because she felt generally a little bit more relaxed around the grandson. She was distracted, not thinking about her throat very much. So that's what she went away to try. And she did it. And when, next time she came back, there was no pot that she was spitting out into. And she, it kind of prepared the ground for her to begin to start some attempts at swallowing.
That's fantastic. What a great story.
She progressed very quickly after that.
That's fantastic. Well, I don't know. Sometimes people listening to this podcast may not have read your, the articles that are presented, but I encourage anyone who's listening to read your article because the formulations that you have put in the diagrams were one of my favorite parts. It really helped me visualize what you're doing in terms of these negative thoughts, these unproductive or unhelpful, I think you called it, thoughts, and how to go about addressing those. And it was such a good visual, and I loved it. Is that part of CBT? Is that something that you just came up with?
That is part of CBT, and that is one of its probably one of the key characteristics of developing a formulation with a patient. And so very often what you're kind of encouraging is them to acknowledge that they are kind of stuck in a vicious cycle, and this is what's maintaining the problem. And so one way of so any attempts to try and modify that cycle, you're trying to sort of break it.
Right.
And like I said, it's very individual, and you're doing it together with the patient. Either usually I use a whiteboard, or if you're at the bedside, a pen and paper, and give that patient the formulation to go home with so that they can reflect back on it.
I think this is one of the best techniques you could use in order to not only individualize a treatment, but also to give someone a visual of what's going on and how to fix it. It's really helpful.
I think people often say when it's up on the whiteboard, you know that it's going well when somebody says, that's exactly it. That's everything that's in my head, and
Wow.
I can see it.
I mean, that's really my favorite part about your research article. I love it. I love so many things about it. So, but that was just like one of the highlights in my eyes. So you said that you received some supervision from an expert practitioner, a CBT practitioner, every 2 to 3 weeks.
That's right. And I think I mean, I was fortunate at this particular time that came from doing the diploma, and because it was a funded study, I had access to a really good psychologist. And so we would spend time going through cases and looking at my treatment plans as to where we'd got to with that. And I guess the other thing to say is that I think our head and neck cancer caseload are often very complex. They may have had some really quite difficult experiences and pre-morbid sort of issues around mood and addictions and things like that. So they are can be really complex to work with. So it's important, I think, that those supervision sessions were really important to ensure that I wasn't overstepping the mark into something that was, more complicated psychologically than I could deal with. And obviously, for a small number of individuals, they could be so depressed that they're vulnerable for self-harm. And so all these sorts of things, it's so important to get good quality supervision. But and as part of that, you get the learning, and I think some of the techniques, broadening out of some wry techniques. I think as speech therapists, we're probably quite comfortable with working with the behaviours, working in that hierarchical kind of way. Sometimes, for me personally, working with cognitive therapy was more challenging and more new to me. So that was quite useful to have good supervision around that. And now I fortunately have got access to a clinical psychologist who supervises me. And I, once I became trained in CBT, it opened up this whole caseload of medically unexplained dysphagias as well, which seemed to come becoming my way too, which is probably a whole different podcast.
I'd love to hear about it.
I'm sure clinicians will recognise the individuals that, you know, it's been, they can't find anything abnormal on a videofluoroscopy or on a FEES, and yet people, you know, have a fear of choking, and so in the absence of any physical condition, and I have used a lot of CBT with those individuals too.
If you're trained in CBT, but you don't have access to a psychologist, is there any harm in using it, or should we maybe not?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I would encourage, encourage access to trying to find access to supervision, because not only for the patient, but for the therapist as well. You know, sessions can sometimes be really quite hard, really hard work emotionally as well, because it can get you to some really quite emotionally drawing discussions.
Right.
So if possible, and it doesn't, you know, I think that supervision could take many different forms. So it could be group supervision, or it could be tele supervision. I've done that before with some therapists. It's, you know, I think the ideal is to try and find a supervisor.
Yeah. So how would you go about that?
I think you'd want to find somebody who is with an interest in CBT, because not all psychologists may have views on CBT that may not be there. Just as we as therapists have different skill sets, so I think it's worth sort of checking out whether CBT is something that they are using, and whether they feel comfortable supervising somebody. And I guess within the National Health Service here in the UK, I'm not sure how it would work over in the States, but usually there, you know, we have departments that I would sort of call upon to kind of ask around to try and find a good supervisor. And of course, you need to have a good relationship with that supervisor too, don't you? You know,
right. Well, I think it's a lot easier to find someone who is interested in doing CBT with a cancer patient than it is to find someone, a psychologist who knows how to speak aphasia,
yeah.
Honestly. So I think I could easily find someone to in my area who would be interested in collaborating with me and giving me their insight. And I guess I think the trick is getting the patient on board with being seen by the psychologist as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I know this is it's a feasibility study, and I know that, you know, you're not saying, hey, we should be doing this. I'm just curious about the logistics.
One of the barriers is accessing supervision, you know, certainly here in the UK. But I guess that comes out of training as well. What one thing that this my paper hasn't addressed, it's obviously just me that's been delivering this intervention, is you know, what level of training would be required, and what the follow-up might be required after that. So once you have a number of people delivering an intervention like this, then that could form a kind of group supervision session that, you know, people will try different things, report back, see how that worked. People will chip in with other ideas. Have you thought about it this way? And I think that that can work really, really nicely as a kind of a supervisory kind of group.
I was just curious about that. I have a brother who's a psychologist.
All right. Okay.
And he is a consultant as well for motivational interviewing. He's a trainer.
Okay, great.
So a lot of the information I've received and a lot of the training that I've received has come from him.
Yes.
And I'm in a fortunate position there. And so I recognize that, and I recognize that not every SLP has this good fortune. But I have been thinking about, you know, what would it take? What kind of training would it take for SLPs to use some of these techniques and not just think about counseling as a general idea? You know, you have a psychologist who's using these really, these trained techniques. They're extensively trained in using these techniques, and they're aware of the pitfalls, and they're aware of what my brother tells me. Well, you have to be careful when you're using a technique that it doesn't cause unintended harm, unintended consequences. I don't know. But what would it take for SLPs to just use some of the techniques? You have any thoughts about that?
I think obviously the next steps of this particular research would be to take it out and to get more speech therapists trained in it, and then try and plan the supervision around that carefully. One barrier is, of course, access to being in the same room as somebody. So I could see that actually, even just over Skype or something like that, it's or even over a telephone call, I think those sorts of things can work. It's trying to be creative about that. It's difficult. I think that's one of the biggest barriers behind it.
Well, this is just an idea, and I don't know if this has crossed your mind, but since you are uniquely trained in that you have training in CBT, and you're a therapist, and you are a researcher, have you ever thought about joining forces with the psychologists that you know who are trained in CBT and offering some kind of seminar or course?
So we do have in the past run some seminars on it, and that people have really enjoyed that,
I'm sure.
And I think it's that sort of ongoing sort of support and supervision beyond that, because it's a bit like learning to drive, isn't it? The real test comes when you're out there on your own in the car.
it's not one of those exercises you can train someone to do. It's really it's so individual, and it's like I said, it's just not something, it's not easily trainable.
That's true, and I think even I was thinking about this today, actually, because I was seeing somebody today that initially I thought she was a little bit more on this sort of panic cycle, that fear of choking, but then it emerged that there were some things that were coming through that I thought, that now that sounds a little bit more sort of obsessive compulsive type of anxiety disorder, and I'm more familiar with working with panic cycles now, because I think that's actually not that that's probably one of the most common sort of cycle that I think I see, and I was thinking I must go back to my supervisor and just go over the obsessive compulsive kind of anxiety disorder again, because I didn't know on the spot where to go with that. And so I guess it's
interesting.
We all need that helping hand, don't we?
Interesting. Yeah, definitely. You know, if you're not extensively trained in it, and even if you are, perhaps you always have that patient who tests your knowledge and skills.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So that's right. That's right. It makes me excited to hear that there's a clinician, a researcher out there who's who sees the benefit of collaborating with psychologists, especially when there's such a strong psychosocial element in what in the patient population that we treat.
Yeah, I think you just reminded me of another point, actually, Megan, because we have a psychologist that's attached to our team, thankfully.
Wow.
But she has got limited sessions, less sessions than the speech and language therapist. And so very often it means that the most extreme cases are referred to her. But also a number of patients, trying to get them along to psychology, you know, can be a struggle.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, and so if as a speech and language therapist, I always try and be explicit about what I'm doing if I'm using a more CBT style approach, in saying, look, you know, I wonder if this approach might be suitable for you if we look at your swallowing problem in this way. And so it's a talking therapy, you know, it's a psychosocial sort of therapy. And that seems to be much more acceptable than saying, I'm wondering if the clinical psychologist might be able to help here.
You hit the nail on the head. That is really what my thought is. How many times I try to put it out there that maybe you should see a psychologist, maybe you should see a mental health professional and they can help you with this issue. And many people are seeing so many different health professionals that the thought of seeing another one or the thought of having another appointment or this is a very difficult and highly emotional topic. It's not something that they say, I think that sounds good, you know. It's something that is scary to them, and
very much so.
So I feel like this is, if we could do something that perhaps it's not exclusively psychological based, but it's something that, well, we have a few techniques up our sleeve that could look at, you know, more of the psychosocial elements, and then if we see something that it's out of our realm, then we have to say we can only go so far with this.
I think it's just made me think about some cases where it's got us into the realms of fear of recurrence and fear of dying. And that, to me, is beginning to move away from the role of a speech and language therapist and into the realm of psychology. And so there have been some patients whereby we have tried to set a priority about whether, if that's their priority to deal with, then maybe we should be looking more towards the clinical psychology, because I think that's stepping out of my area.
That's helpful to know.
Yeah, but by which case, if you've been working in this way, you've kind of, if you like, softened up the idea of what a talking therapy might be like, because you've already engaged with them in that way. And then you can say, well, the psychologist will just be doing something similar to the sorts of work that we have been doing, but she'll just be focusing on the worries you have about disease coming back. And so I don't know. I don't know for sure, but I think that helps facilitate referral.
Definitely. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking it's kind of easing their way into it.
Yeah.
And building a little bit more confidence. And perhaps this is something that maybe you really should consider, because you are starting to see the value in it. You're buying into it.
Yeah.
If you think this is helping, I can, you know, I know someone who can do a lot more, perhaps, in this area.
Yeah.
So
I
see a lot of decisional regret and recurrence. Anxiety.
Yeah.
But decisional regret is another one that I wonder if that's something. It's sometimes it really restricts someone from going further. You know, they're so stuck in their decision and their regret.
Yeah. Sometimes that sort of rumination.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
So do you think
really.
that would be useful to, you know, in our prac in our scope, or do you think that's kind of like the fear of recurrence, fear of dying part, and maybe we shouldn't touch that?
I wonder if I mean there are even within the realms of the CBT. So, for example, the lady I was telling you about earlier on, that I think there's a panic cycle going on with OCD. That there's evidence that shows that if you work on the panic cycle, the OCD will also improve. So I guess it's a matter of, and it comes back to individualizing it, is does the patient want to prioritize the area of eating and drinking and go and leave the decision regret for the time being, or is that the most important thing that you want to work on, in which case then maybe we need to think about diverting for the time being and coming back to this other the other issue at another date. Because I think if somebody is ruminating and ruminating, it can be very difficult then to make headway into this other area.
You're right. Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. So, going back to what you said, you know, how you individualize, you look at therapy goals and complaints and really priorities of what that person wants to work on. And then you decide where to go in for your formulations and your referrals, perhaps. Okay. That makes sense. Well, it sounds like not only clinicians would find this useful, but the It sounds like the participants really liked this as well. You said that some of them reported that they wished they would have received CBEST earlier, or that they could continue it, which says a lot.
That's it was always very nice to hear. I mean, I guess it's been interesting because as I've been presenting this work as well, some people have also said, "Oh, do you think you could start this earlier, like during radiotherapy?" And I think there is something to be said for that. I think that as part of healthcare, often healthcare professionals are quite rightly giving advice and educating patients. So I guess that sets up a sort of paternalism relationship. And I guess one could start this self-management idea earlier on throughout treatment. But I think one of the difficulties is that one of the barriers to people taking up this treatment was some felt it was too much to take on early on following their treatment because they were just feeling
Overwhelmed.
and because it is a very collaborative style of therapy, you need that engagement. And yet for some individuals, if they were prepared to sort of engage at some level, just breaking it down to very small steps enabled them to move forward. So again, I think it's horses for courses. I don't know if that's a British saying.
It's a British thing, definitely. What does that mean? Sense. You know, that was one of my questions. Should that have been started? Could we start it earlier? Do you envision starting earlier? And gosh, that's a silly question because it's so individualized. You can't make a blanket statement about when to start something like this.
Which makes it difficult to research, doesn't it? That's the
It
problem.
does. Head and neck cancer patients are just the most difficult to study, in my opinion. There's just so many elements and so many different factors involved. It's when you're looking at research, you're supposed to be narrowing your question. And it's really hard to narrow your question when there's so many different factors. And then that really limits the amount of people you can study. You're already at a disadvantage with head and neck cancer patients. The amount of people in studies are typically pretty low.
Yeah.
That makes sense. It's all about individualizing.
Yeah, I mean, one research group in Newcastle in Australia, there's a clinical psychologist there. I don't know if you're familiar with the paper that is called Eat as Treatment or something along those lines. I can't remember the title, but it's where dietitians have been trained in motivational interviewing and using motivational interviewing during radiotherapy to encourage oral intake and good nutritional intake during that time. And I can see that, well, it'd be interesting to see what your brother would think about that, but, you know, potentially a shorter, sort of quicker kind of intervention during that time to keep people eating and drinking.
That's really interesting, because my understanding of motivational interviewing is that someone has to be ambivalent about whether or not they want to change. And for people who are undergoing chemoradiation or have had resections and what have you, it's not just about whether they want to or not. It's sometimes they just physically can't bring themselves to doing it.
Yeah.
So do you see any patterns in people who are prime candidates for people, I mean, for, you know, using this CBEST?
Yes, I do, actually. There are some people that all you need to do is to develop that formulation with them and for them to see, that's why I'm stuck. You know how I was saying earlier how some people see it all on the whiteboard and say, yes, that's exactly it.
They just need to visualize it.
Yeah, and that actually that's why, that's linked to that. That's why I'm feeling that way.
Okay.
But it kind of reminds me of a guy who participated in this study. And he was a pretty high-flying corporate kind of a guy and really into goals and things. You know, I'm pretty sure he was a long-distance runner and, you know, into training. You could just see that that's the way in which he lived his life beforehand. But then after he had his treatment, he just shut himself away in his bedroom, didn't see anyone, was feeding through a nasogastric tube and just watching TV. That's all he did. He came and we looked at that formulation, obviously had really low mood at this time, understood that that really wasn't helping in any way, shape or form, that he could do some things that would make things different. And within, it must have only been about 10 to 14 days where he made such a shift, because once he started to leave his bedroom, he started to be with his family, he started to feel better, he was doing a bit more, and then he realized actually that that was just holding him back. So very quickly he moved forward.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it stands out in my mind that actually, you know, just one session with him,
wow,
he really, it made a huge difference.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
So those are, you know, ambitious people, people who have problems kind of like linking the causes and effects of their behavior and their unhelpful thoughts.
Yeah.
Do you have anyone else who might be a really great candidate for this, or maybe people who are not good candidates for this?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you think conversely, that the sort of person, for some individuals, it's really hard to draw out either emotions or thoughts. And I'm also thinking about another guy who actually we could access the formulation, but he really had quite significant low mood.
Depression was just the barrier.
Yeah, and so for him, we had to do, I think when he was so low that thinking of any other alternative way of being or doing things was really difficult. And so we started off with some very small steps of building on the sorts of things that he used to do before. And I think he used to do painting. That was one of his things that he used to enjoy beforehand, is painting. And so he was going to do some, it was just sorting out of the colours of the paint, not even painting itself, and even just getting him away from the television. daytime television in the UK is not good. And
Nor
so
is
just
it in America, so.
so it's going to make you depressed.
Yeah.
So him just getting away from the TV, going off and doing a small task, lifted his mood sufficiently. And I think if you can lift mood a little bit, then he also went off and then made himself a cup of tea. And this is how, if you can shift that mood a little bit, then the eating and drinking sometimes will move along with it.
Interesting.
And so for him, it took, he took the whole 10 sessions, and I think he could probably have benefited from a little bit more than that.
Now, I was thinking perhaps people who have baseline diagnosis of depression, hopefully, if those people are being seen by a psychologist and you're working on that in the therapy
Yeah.
aspect, you might see better results. I was just thinking, did that man have, was he being seen by a psychologist? Did he have a diagnosis before?
I would probably think he was quite vulnerable before, yeah, to kind of stress. I think he'd had quite a lot of stress in his life, and he described periods of low mood beforehand, but never sought any help. He also had no voice. He'd had a laryngectomy, and so he didn't want to use his valve. So there's a communication issue that's going on there too. And I think that he didn't want to go to the psychologist.
Well, that brings up another issue, really. I mean, there are just some physical restrictions and people wanting to do talk therapy with a psychologist. I can see that being a factor in someone's consideration.
It was slow. It was slow paced work, but it had to be. But he made progress.
Well, that's a win for us, right?
Definitely. I think it was just that he needed more time, I think.
I think the idea of counseling and also individualizing goes hand in hand. And you mentioned using the Chalder fatigue questionnaire in your study. And I was really interested because I've never heard of that. I use the Omni scale. I don't know if you know about that, but
No, I've not used that. I mean, using a fatigue scale is quite new to me.
okay.
And I guess this really came out of some of the qualitative work that I'd done for my PhD that seemed to patients sometimes saw low energy, fatigue after cancer treatment as a barrier to getting back to eating and drinking, because eating and drinking was effortful. And so they didn't really have the energy to even attempt things. And yet it also struck me that patients didn't really get much guidance of when, how much activity they should be doing, whether they should be resting, or whether they should be trying to sort of build themselves up, get more stamina. And so a lot of in many patients, I was doing quite a lot of what we call activity scheduling, which is going through somebody's day in very fine detail,
That's what
working
I
out
do too.
the
Have
schedule.
it's called habit formation counseling. Do you know that? I didn't know that until I talked to my brother. Oh, he says, "You're doing habit formation counseling."
It's so useful, isn't it?
Yes.
And I think if you are just focusing in on eating and drinking and forgetting about the rest of the day, you miss out on actually how is this fitting into your day? What is your day looking
Exactly.
like?
Exactly.
Oh, that's great.
Yes. And there's a lot of good research about it.
Well, I do find that really useful. And I guess also trying to just sort of build up physical activity as well, and really cutting back down on those daytime naps. that sometimes people can get into, which then means that they're not sleeping well at night. And it all just means that you're building a more holistic.
It's a big picture. You used that questionnaire to track people's fatigue. Was that meant to progressivize your session?
It was good to get as an assessment for an individual, and also useful to look at it as an outcome measure that other things were changing too, as well as the eating and drinking performance. So
I have not thought about using a fatigue questionnaire. I mean, do you find it useful to use as a clinician?
It was a quick tool to use, actually. So yes, I would probably, I don't use it in such a systematic way at present clinically, but I would use it if somebody was, if I was going to be working with somebody using this style of intervention. I think that's helpful. I think it's helpful for patients to see as well, isn't it?
Definitely. Is it accessible? Is it free?
It's free. Yeah. It's free and very easy to score, which I like.
Yeah, it's nice. So one thing I wondered about specifically was, you know, a lot of the recent research indicates that head and neck cancer survivorship has the best outcomes when there's multidisciplinary collaboration and people are health professionals from various fields are working together collaboratively.
Yeah.
You mentioned that patients were referred to participate in the study either by a speech language pathologist or a specialist nurse. And
the nurses were really on board with it, actually. I've worked in the teams where I did my research for a number of years now. So I think that always helps, doesn't it? You know, I think they had a sense of trust as well. And I guess the majority came from speech and language therapists, but mainly that's probably because that's where my recruitment drive usually was. But in fact, some of the dietitians as well were very keen to put people forward for this intervention. And I think some of the symptoms we were working on would include things like fatigue and pain, where some of the nursing staff might touch on those things too. And this is one of the difficulties, I think, with trying to keep your research as pure as possible whilst being pragmatic, because for some of those pain issues, and I'm not an expert obviously in pain management, but some of the things that some of the patients were doing in order to manage their pain, like pacing up and down the room, holding their head, or you know, these sorts of things, we kind of worked alongside that as well. So I realized that it was beginning to mesh some of our professional roles. So I needed to make sure that the specialist nurses and the dietitians were on board with that too. In an ideal way, in an ideal world, a more pragmatic world, we would probably be all approaching this problem in the same. But because this was research, it had to be kept as pure as it could be for the purposes of measurement. But yeah, I think, you know, for a number of those sorts of common symptoms like fatigue and pain, I think there's a role for CBT with that too, alongside obviously addressing the physical.
Okay, that's helpful. Some participants were permanently MPO but had social eating goals.
Yeah.
And I wondered how you used CBT with them. These people did not want to do swallowing exercises.
No.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked about this particular case group, because I think, I'm sure you'll come across people that actually aren't able to eat and drink again. You know, either from really extensive fibrosis, where the risks are just too high for choking, or they are coming back with repeated chest infections or possible admissions for pneumonia. And I have one particular guy that really sticks out in my mind. And he had experienced that, you know, over the course of a year, his swallowing had just deteriorated. He had extensive scarring. and had been in hospital a couple of times with his chest, so had taken the decision to have a gastrostomy put back in, and but that left him incredibly low. And again, he didn't want to go to the psychologist, but this problem was very much related to the idea that he would not be able to eat and drink again, and that's a huge loss for people, isn't it? And I guess that left me with the challenge of what do you do with these individuals? You know, you're not working towards getting a feeding tube out, but you're trying to find a way that they can live their lives in the absence of eating and drinking. And this is where the therapy approach of acceptance and commitment therapy came in.
Okay.
So I don't know if you've heard of acceptance and commitment therapy.
I haven't. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's kind of related to CBT in a way, but the essence of it is that it's in some ways a kind of acceptance of those unwanted experiences that are out with the personal control. So he couldn't control the fact that he was unable to physically swallow, and then taking some kind of committed action towards rebuilding a valued life. So we spent some time just looking at what his values were, what was a valued life, what was important to this individual. And you know, because he was really saying, what is the point in life if I can't eat and drink? And he was also ruminating a lot on these unanswered questions of why has this happened to me? You know, it was this profound loss. And but really at the heart of his values was he was a family man, and you know, that was the most important, that's what made life worth living for him, is that he had a couple of kids and his wife, and that's where his values kind of lay. So we kind of worked on that, to thinking about how could he spend time with his family and gain some pleasure out of living out that value, whilst acknowledging that he had this loss of eating and drinking. So one example might be that he really struggled with going out shopping with his family. So the local shopping centre where they parked, he would have to go past the food court in order to get to the shops, and his attention would be completely on everybody that was eating in the food court and looking at all the food. You know, food almost became a central focus that he could not think or shift that attention onto something else. So it was about a way of kind of spending time with his family, but without being confronted and not having his attention shifted in that way. And one of the things he used to do actually is that he would spend his Saturdays going out fishing, and when he was fishing with some pals, it was a way of being with friends, but without this eating experience, you know, and eating getting in the way of unsettling him and leading him to ruminate again about his losses. And so it's just finding a way that he could get this more valued life for himself. Yeah, so it's a difficult one to work with, and I'm not sure there's a lot out there to equip us to really work with somebody's loss.
There are certain people who CBT would be great to use with, but there are certain people perhaps who might be better for the acceptance commitment therapy.
Yeah.
So that MPO participant, is that considered CBEST?
I think it's often called the third wave of CBT. Kind of aligned in the same way that mindfulness is kind of aligned with to.
Okay.
I think that is a particular subgroup that perhaps needs looking at in a bit.
I understand what you're saying.
If you think about the outcomes for the enhanced swallowing therapy, my main sort of outcome, anticipated outcome measure would be the MD Anderson dysphagia inventory. Well, somebody like him is always going to score low on that because they're not eating and drinking. But some of the work that we did facilitated the resolution around not eating and drinking anymore and trying to find a life around that still.
So is there a measurement tool to track that outcome?
I don't think there is. Yeah, I think that's one of the issues with the MDADI, isn't it? That it comes at it from, it's always difficult to find. Those questions may not always suit somebody who is gastrostomy fed totally, and there's some of those questions don't make sense to an individual. It's difficult to complete.
We need to have some kind of quality of life measure.
Yeah, it's making sure, because often people with dysphagia feel like they're hugely missing out, don't they?
Right.
And this is, I guess, maybe a quicker way of telling you about that patient would be, it was trying to find ways that he didn't miss out quite so much.
Right. So you'd have to look at other aspects than eating.
Yeah, other ways of spending your life, your day-to-day.
Right.
So that this living with dysphagia isn't such a huge thing that's stopping you from gaining pleasure from other aspects.
There's the hospital anxiety depression scale, the HADS.
In the qualitative interviews and things that he talked a lot about, how it helped him.
Right. As people are listening to this, you know, well, then what do I do with these people? Well,
yeah.
There are anxiety depression scales, the HADS.
Yeah.
But nothing specific, perhaps, for head and neck cancer. I just have to, but maybe that's an opportunity for you to develop something.
Yeah, just thinking about those, because even when I think, you know, those conversations you might have in clinic where you know that this patient is probably heading down towards needing to have a gastrostomy put back in, I don't know about you, but it always is a difficult conversation.
Oh, incredibly difficult.
Breaking to people, and I guess part of that is because what else do we offer to this individual in order to help them through that transition?
A lot of, you know, I work with both neurogenic population and head neck cancer, and
yeah.
I work with PTs and OTs, and so I often hear the term spontaneous recovery, and I know that that's a part of the neurogenic population, but when I think about the head neck cancer population, spontaneous recovery, I don't know if that's a possibility, if that's probably, there is a little bit of that. But then you use the term spontaneous adjustment, and I love that term. Is that something that you created?
I don't know if you're familiar with the term response shift when you think about patient-reported outcome measures. So a response shift could occur on a questionnaire. A change for the positive could occur because the physical problem has got better, or it could occur because you've got somebody with a slightly who finds adjusting to adversity easier than the next person, or there may be something about their personality, they're more optimistic looking, outward looking, better coping skills, and therefore they have a response shift on that questionnaire. So I guess when I was doing the research, I had to consider that, you know, it may be that the physical condition of the swallowing could have got better over the course of me delivering this intervention. That may account for why the scores improved from pre to post. Or it may be that some of these individuals naturally had some quite good coping skills anyway, that they would have harnessed those. But having said that, because I have a big database that was a hangover from my PhD, particularly on the MD Anderson, I think the shift in scores kind of made me think that and made me more confident that it was due to the intervention rather than the spontaneous adjustment. Because I'm not sure spontaneous adjustment occurs over such a short space of time. So, but I had to acknowledge that it was a potential source of bias for the scores that I was reporting.
Well, and it segues into, you know, a lot of these patients reported loving this treatment technique, but sometimes there were no changes on the HADS. So what do you think happened there?
Yeah, and I'm glad that you asked that question, because the HADS was important to do because I wanted to make sure I wasn't working with somebody with quite severe depression or anxiety. And so on the HADS, none of the patients, I don't think, from what I can recall, had a caseness of depression and anxiety. So in many ways, that was reassuring that within this group, the mood shift was due to the association with the physical symptoms that they were experiencing. So I think that's my explanation for why the HADS didn't shift, but the quality of life measures, the dysphagia, specific quality of life measure, and the diet scale shifted.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So you're saying that the patients didn't have significant anxiety, depression to start with, and it was more quality of life struggle, and you can better capture that in the MDADI.
That was the purpose of the intervention. And when I first of all saw that on the HADS, I thought, oh, that surprised me too. But then when I sat and thought about this treatment isn't for clinical cases of depression or anxiety.
So you talked a little bit about teletherapy.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm really interested in teletherapy, especially for this type of intervention, because I think it would lend itself really well to it. I could see that there could be potential barriers.
Such as?
Well, I think that even as we're talking now, for instance, it is just unusual to keep eye contact, isn't it? And, you know, when your camera is slightly off.
Yes, you're right.
And so if it's fine, as obviously when we're kind of chatting, but I'm just imagining somebody with a low mood. I don't know how that would work, and you know, it obviously does work because there's good evidence behind CBT for anxiety and depression, but maybe it's just me as a therapist. I would just need to get more accustomed to delivering my therapy in that way.
Do you have any plans for that?
I would like to do it, actually, because I think, you know, for healthcare now, we have to look at cost effectiveness. And if we're saying that training is required in order to deliver this sort of intervention, it may not be the sort of thing that every therapist wants to get involved with. And so that means that there's probably going to be a small number of therapists who are willing to deliver this sort of treatment. And wouldn't it be great if there was equal access for patients wherever you lived, you know, whether that's in a very rural area, or if it's a short trip to the hospital, because otherwise patients that live at distance are really disadvantaged in the sort of services they can access. I guess it's just thinking through about the technology, the technologies around that, and people's access to good quality kind of video conferencing calls. I do think that it's the way forward with something like this. I think the Australians are way ahead, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they...
Is there anything that you recommend us to read?
Yeah, if you look at, it'll be Elizabeth Ward's group from Brisbane, who have published a lot on their teletherapy. And I guess, you know, we think we have rural here in the UK, but I guess in Australia it's a completely different... on another scale completely. So I guess they have a stronger history in telecommunications for healthcare, and I think what they've done is great for delivery of speech and language therapy in the outback.
Well, my final question. So, based on what you've learned in your research, do you have any advice for clinicians who are interested in studying the head and neck cancer patient population?
I think I think that probably probably post PhD, I realized going back clinically that there is a lot of merit in the systematic collection of outcome measures to evaluate what you're doing, and I think the trick is not to go overboard in the number of outcome measures that you're collecting, because otherwise your data quality goes down. The more you collect, the less likely it is that you'll get a complete data. And I think at a minimum, I think it's doing a pre and a post collection of outcome measures, and I think that's a good way of getting sort of started. But having said that, I think it's that acknowledgement that this is often what we're doing is very, very complex in our interventions. So when we're trying something new, then we just do a very small pilot. So one example of that is we recently have completed a study where we've been looking at using hypnosis for taste dysfunction.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's been a very interesting study.
Wow.
And so for that, we just used 10 patients and took outcome measures before we started, delivered and recorded the intervention very carefully, and re-administered those outcome measures after the intervention. And I think that's taught us a lot about what's important, where we might expect to see change, and how those outcome measures behave under those sorts of conditions. So I think that's probably the critical bit, is the routine collection, systematic collection of a small number of outcome measures, but relating those outcome measures to the intervention that you're doing.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think so often we're really tempted to use all kinds of different, really exciting measurements, and then we kind of lose track. And what are we really looking at here? Oh, what a joy it's been talking with you. I have just I could talk
Oh,
with you.
Megan, you've been a very kind interviewer.
Oh, no, I just love your work, and I'm so excited. I'm just honored to have your time, and I realize your time is so valuable, and I really appreciate you just agreeing to do this and talking with me candidly about your work, and it's just been such a pleasure.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think it's always interesting to see. To discuss it and to have, some really great questions. And it gets me thinking again about it, thinking, oh yeah, maybe I need to look at that grid in a slightly different way. So thank you.
Well, I'm constantly looking for your work, so.
Well, thanks, Megan.
The lively theme music for the SLP Minded podcast was written by my fellow SLP and good friend, Justin Berry. Thank you so much for providing us your musical talent and creativity, Justin. You rock. And thanks everyone for listening to today's show.